Today is October the 28th, 2020. It's National Chocolate Day. National Chocolate Day celebrates all things chocolate. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Twitter, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The Justice Department filed suit against Google for maintaining an illegal monopoly. In its suit, filed in a federal court in Washington, D.C., the agency accused Google, a unit of Alphabet, of illegally maintaining its monopoly over search through several exclusive business contracts and agreements that lock out competition. Such contracts include Google's payment of billions of dollars to Apple to place the Google search engine as the default of the iPhones. By using contracts to maintain its monopoly, competition and innovation has suffered, the suit says. A victory for the government could make one of America's most recognizable companies and the internet economy that it has helped define. The government said that Google has maintained its monopoly power through exclusionary practices that are harmful to competition. Google is the gateway to the internet and the search of advertising behemoth. The suit reflects the pushback against the technology giants like Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. Conservatives and liberals have been highly critical of the concentration of power in a handful of tech behemoths. The lawsuit may stretch on for years, though, and could set off a cascade and other antitrust lawsuits from state attorney generals. About four dozen states and jurisdictions have conducted parallel investigations and are expected to bring separate complaints against the company's grip on technology for online advertising. But Google has long denied accusations of antitrust violations and is expected to fight the government's effort by using a global network of lawyers, economists, and lobbyists. Alphabet, valued at over $1 trillion and with cash reserve of over $120 billion, has fought similar antitrust lawsuits in Europe. The company says it has strong competition in the search market, with more people finding information on sites like Amazon. It says its services have been a boon for small businesses. The lawsuit comes lawmakers on the House Judiciary Committee released a report on the tech giants that accuse Google of controlling a monopoly over online search and the ads that come up when users enter a query. The lawmakers also accuse Apple, Amazon, and Facebook of abusing their market power. The scrutiny reflects how Google has become a dominant player in communications, commerce, and media over the last 20 years. It controls 90% of the market for online searches, according to one estimate. The business is quite lucrative. Last year, Google brought in $34.3 billion in search revenue in the United States, according to the research firm eMarketer, and that figure is expected to grow to $42.5 billion by 2022. The lawsuit is the result of an investigation that has stretched for more than a year. Prosecutors have spoken with Google's rivals in technology and media, collecting information and documents that could be used to build a case. Google last faced serious scrutiny from an American antitrust regulator nearly a decade ago when the Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, investigated whether it had abused its power over the search market. The agency staff recommended bringing charges against the company, but the agency's five commissioners voted in 2013 not to bring a case. Other governments have been more aggressive, though, against the big tech companies. The European Union has brought three antitrust suits against Google in recent years, focused on its search engine, advertising business, and Android mobile operating system. Regulators in Britain and Australia are examining the digital advertising market in inquiries that could ultimately implicate the company. It's the most newsworthy monopolization action brought by the government since the Microsoft case in the late 90s. It's significant in that the government believes that a highly successful tech platform has engaged in conduct that maintains its monopoly power unlawfully and as a result injures consumers and competition. The government's case against Microsoft took more than a decade to settle, and I don't expect this to move any faster. Amazon to pay Amazon customers for intelligence when they're not shopping on Amazon. After spending years promising Congress that the data it collected from third-party sellers wasn't used to beef up its private label products, Amazon introduced the Shopper Panel, which promises to pay Amazon customers that offer intelligence to the e-commerce giant about where they shop when they're not shopping on Amazon.com. While Amazon still doesn't collect non-public seller data, the new program is designed to get that information anyway from you, the customer. Here's how the Shopper Panel works. After getting an e-receipt from any of the panelists, they can either submit a picture of that receipt through the app or, in the case of digital copies, forward the emailed details to a panel-specific email address. According to the panel website, folks that upload at least 10 receipts per month can either cash that in for $10 in Amazon credit or $10 donated to their charity of choice. Along with that baseline payout, the app will also dole out additional earnings to panelists who answer the occasional survey after certain brands or products within the app. Not every receipt counts toward this program, though. Receipts from grocery stores, drug stores, restaurants, and movie theaters, along with just about any other retailer or entertainment outlet, are fair game. However, receipts from casinos, gun stores, transit fare, tuition, or apartment rentals, no, they're not part of the program. While the program is invite-only for now, any curious Amazon customer based in the United States can download the panel app from the iOS App Store or the Google Play Store if they want to put their name on the wait list. Under the Amazon Panel Site Privacy tab, the company notes that any receipts that you share will go towards helping brands offer better products and making ads more relevant on Amazon. The company also notes that any data gleaned from these receipts or surveys might also be used to improve the product selection on Amazon.com and affiliate stores such as Whole Foods Market, and to improve the content offered through Amazon services such as Prime Video. By the way, this reminds me of the secret shopper. Amazon has come under an increasing barrage of regulatory fire from authorities, both in the United States and in Europe, over a scandal that largely revolved around tracking consumers' purchase data, not unlike the data pulled from the average receipt on its platform. The Wall Street Journal revealed that Amazon had spent years surveilling the purchases earned by the platform's third-party sellers, specifically to create its own competing products under the Amazon private label. This comes out barely a year after Amazon's associate general counsel told Congress that the company didn't use individual seller data to do just that. Amazon doesn't have access to the same purchase-by-purchase data from the brick-and-mortar sellers that Amazon competes with online. Paying people for their receipts for these sellers ensures Amazon will have a steady stream of data from its competitors. In a message to advertisers about the official rollout of the panel program, the company noted that customers routinely use Amazon to discover and learn about products before purchasing them elsewhere. In fact, Amazon only represents 4% of U.S. retail sales. But it's a point that ignores how more and more of our purchases are happening online overall, and how more and more of those purchases are happening through Amazon. One 2020 report of major e-commerce companies found that close to 39% of all online sales happened under Amazon's watch. Its biggest competitor was Walmart, which controlled a little more than 5%. And now that Amazon is dipping into an in-person purchase data, that percentage may dwindle even further. Nokia blocks Lenovo from selling any laptops, PCs or tablets in Germany, and is seeking similar injunctions in Brazil, India, and the United States. An injunction is preventing Lenovo from selling most of its products on its German website. Lenovo has had to remove almost all its products from its German website because of a patent dispute with Nokia. The Chinese company has supposedly been violating H.264 patents that Nokia holds, resulting in the Finnish company taking out an injunction to freeze Lenovo's online sales. H.264 refers to a section of the MPEG-4 standards document that describes a video encoding method. There are many other video encodings, but they tend to be suited to specific purposes. H.264 offers more efficient space compression at the cost of more complex encoding. If you're willing to stray from the MPEG standards, there are hundreds or more encoding options. Lenovo has been caught violating Nokia patents, a court in Munich has found, and the dispute relates to Nokia patents over H.264 video compression standard, which Lenovo had been using on its German website. Apparently, Lenovo and Nokia have been unable to agree to license payments, so Nokia sought an injunction against Lenovo. The result is Lenovo cannot currently sell laptops, PCs, or tablets on its German website. Lenovo continues to sell smartphones on Lenovo.de, but the loss of other products will be a major blow for Lenovo. Third-party retailers may be unable to sell new PCs and tablets produced by Lenovo either. It is unclear for how long the injunction will be imposed on Lenovo. Presumably, Lenovo could resolve the matter by paying Nokia what it believes it is owed, but Nokia claims that Lenovo is yet to make any formal approaches, and instead Lenovo has appealed the judgment. But it faces similar cases with Nokia in Brazil, India, and the United States. Nokia has gone further in the United States too, and has sought an injunction against the import of laptops, tablets, and PCs into the country. Although this refers to a website, they're seeking an injunction against the import of the products. It's all about money. T-Mobile has expanded into the live internet TV business. T-Mobile is finally getting into the live TV business with the launch of a new internet-based streaming service called T-Vision, and it's being launched on November the 1st. T-Vision is a traditional over-the-top streaming service that simply streams live television over the internet, just like YouTube TV, Hulu's live TV service, Fubo TV, Sling TV, or AT&T TV. But what sets T-Vision apart is its pricing, which aims to offer lower cost and more flexibility than its competitors. T-Vision is broken up into a few different products. There's a $40 per month T-Vision Live, which offers the most traditional cable TV line. It focused largely on providing news and sports, including channels like ABC, NBC, and Fox, but not CBS though. News networks like CNBC, CNN, ABC News, and Fox News, along with sports, focus channels like FS1, FS2, ESPN, and NBC Sports. Additionally, T-Vision Live includes general cable fare like the Disney Channel, Cartoon Network, Sci-Fi, TBS, TNT, USA, and Bravo. There are also two additional tiers of T-Vision Live, the $50 Live TV Plus, which adds additional sports channel, including the Big Ten Network, ESPNU, NFL Network, and regional NBC sports channels, and the $60 Live Zone, which adds a few additional channels, but whose main draw is NFL Red Zone. All three T-Vision Live plans also include a cloud-based DVR, which stores up to 100 hours of recordings, and unlike some streaming services, those recordings are direct from the live TV feed, not on-demand content. T-Vision Live supports up to 3 concurrent streams, which means you'll be able to share an account with family members too. But T-Vision Live is just a part of T-Vision. There's also T-Vision Vibe, V-I-B-E, which at $10 a month for over 30 live channels from AMC Discovery and Viacom might be the most interesting part of T-Mobile's TV strategy. Channels here include AMC, BBC America, BET, Food Network, HGTV, The Hallmark Channel, MTV, TLC, Comedy Central, and Discovery. There are a few more limitations here. T-Vision Vibe only supports up to 2 concurrent streams, and DVR access costs an extra $5 per month on top of the initial $10 subscription. But that's very low cost. And if you're interested in the channels it offers, it's among the cheapest live TV packages around. Lastly, there's T-Vision Channels, which offers standalone subscriptions to Stars for less than $9 a month, Showtime for less than $11 per month, and Epix for less than $6 a month. T-Mobile T-Vision services can also be combined. For example, you can subscribe to both T-Vision Live for a basic set of channels and then add T-Vision Vibe on top of those additional entertainment-focused channels, just like regular cable. Those prices certainly are impressive, but other TV services like Fubo or YouTube TV have offered similarly low prices at their launches too, only to raise prices considerably as content licensing costs have gone up. It's not clear yet whether T-Vision's various services will manage to avoid a similar fate in the future. Despite T-Mobile's usual rhetoric about offering a different sort of service than its competitors, T-Vision will be available on a variety of platforms including iOS, Android, Apple TV, Android TV, Amazon Fire, and Google TV. Absent from that list is Roku, which won't be available, at least not at launch time, or any way to watch on a computer. T-Mobile is also offering the $50 T-Vision Hub, a 4K Android TV dongle that's been customized to offer a more integrated T-Vision experience. To start, T-Vision will be available just to T-Mobile postpaid wireless customers starting on November the 1st. Sprint customers will get access later in November, with a service opening up to all customers sometime in 2021. Isn't that great with competition? Hopefully it lowers the prices and you only get what you really want instead of saying you must order the whole batch just to get a few channels. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Coding and Programming.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I bring you my 30 years of IT professional experience, and I translate some of the different things that you experience in the workplace into practical, usable information. One of the things that I was recently contacted about was, what is the difference between coding and being a programmer? Or really more of, what is coding and what is programming? And I'm going to give you kind of an idea. And many people think of coding and programming as synonymous. They think, oh, you're a coder, you're a programmer, you know, and you know, they'll even apply that even when I have not done any coding or programming. So what is the difference? Well, in reality, a lot of us deal with some level of coding. If you are doing anything with Excel in the form of advanced formulas, you're moving towards that coding direction. Especially if you start dealing with VBA, you start dealing with some of the different advanced macros. And this actually, because of the way coding has evolved, many different reports, if you've spent a matter of a couple of days or a couple of weeks developing a lot of the different layers of a report to bring all of this information down, you've got a big bulk of information and you're whittling it down to the 5 different questions you need to ask of all of that information. you're actually moving in a direction where you are not programming, but coding. What is coding? Coding is understanding the different bits and pieces that you've got and utilizing the computer, using it to get the information you need. It's a subset of programming. A programmer is going to know more extreme amounts of information. It's going through and developing a fully functioning standalone solution versus just utilizing whatever language that you've got. Maybe it's even kind of a naturalistic language into different commands in some sort of intermediary location. Again, if you're dealing with Excel, you're not really programming. You're not developing a standalone system, but you are going through and you are manipulating some of the different formulas and algorithms and different ways that you get that information and bring it from one area, from one set of information, to the new area, a smaller set of information. It's not as advanced. It's not as intricate as people might make it out to be. Throughout my life, I have done both programming and coding. The programming part of it is when we start adding in a lot more of the interface so that we are developing all of these formulas on the back end. We're developing a front end that a user will work with. Now, we can think of this. There's a program out there called Microsoft Access. And some of you may have worked with Microsoft Access. This is kind of just a basic version of this. But we go through and we set up a program that end users can enter in a variety of bits and pieces of information. It becomes a standalone system where, yes, we're working through and I'm developing all of the code in the background, all of the different constraints. So you ask the computer program for a report or a series of reports based off of all of the information that Access has gathered. Well, that starts to move in that direction. And there's this ambiguous line in between the two. It's not always, set in stone, but it's more of, here's the thing. Coding is a small part of a solution. It's a small part of a project. It's really just putting together something that's the needs for the moment. Maybe the recurring needs, like you'll set it up, you need it for the moment, and then you keep using it forever and ever. And programming is where we go through and we apply a certain attention to detail. We apply a certain sense of thinking through what the end user is going to be wanting of the program, and we set it up in a form that allows somebody to continue to use it in an automated form, in a ready-to-use application that will continue to work on a long term. Can you learn coding? Yeah. As a matter of fact, most of the coding that we find today, a lot of the different formulas that you might work with, if you're working with Excel, you might find all of the things that you need to accomplish the special tasks online. Even in programming, it involves coding. Programming involves going through and putting together a lot of those different formulas and so forth. But you have to think kind of bigger scale. It becomes more of a project. That programming usually takes a matter of not just hours or a few days, but months of planning and preparing and thinking like an end user and making it far more easy to work with. I hope that kind of gives you a little bit better idea of what's going on. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Like most people with software installed, when an upgrade comes in, You install it on top of the installed application. Well, I know in my case, I've been running a very old version of Microsoft Office, and it does, you know, it's fine. It works well for me. I don't need all the latest stuff. And the version I'm running was Microsoft Office 2010. Yes, I know there's a 2013 and a 2016, and I don't need it. I don't want to pay for something I don't need. Well, I decided then it's about time I move on to 2019. And what I did was I got a copy of the 2019 version where you don't run Office online. You can run it locally. So I installed Office 2019 on top of 2010. It's not considered an upgrade. It's really a replacement. Did I learn something? I had trouble running Office 2019. Things just didn't look right. So I contacted Microsoft, and they said that they advise against running multiple copies for a number of reasons. There are compatibility issues between system files, especially with Outlook. Some features are disabled, and some files are overwritten by the newer version, leaving the older version without those files. Some commands are either obsolete or change, which means one or both versions could fail. Murphy's Law was, in my case, it failed. So, a word to the wise, one thing I learned is, if you're replacing but not upgrading, uninstall the old application before installing the new version of the application. Microsoft recently commissioned a research company, YouGov, to ask 5,000 registered voters about their innermost feelings. One or two deeply felt highlights emerged. 90% of the respondents admitted they're worried every time they share their information online. 70% privately pointed their fingers at the U.S. government. They said it isn't doing enough to protect their personal data. A similar 70% said they'd like to see the next administration enact privacy legislation. Well, these details come from the company's corporate vice president for global privacy and regulatory affairs and chief privacy officer. She is Julie Brill. She began by talking about the importance of data. She said, "Data is critical, not just in rebuilding our economy, but in helping us understand societal inequalities that have contributed to dramatically higher rates of sickness and death among Black communities and other communities of color due to COVID-19. Data can also help us focus resources on rebuilding a more just, fair, and equitable economy that benefits all. A fundamental problem, she said, is a lack of trust in society today. The United States has fallen far behind the rest of the world in privacy protection. In total, over 130 countries and jurisdictions have enacted privacy laws, yet one country has not done so yet, the United States. In contrast to the role our country has traditionally played on global issues, the United States is not leading or even participating in the discussion over common privacy norms." Brill fears other parts of the world will continue to lead in privacy while the United States continue to lead in inaction and chaos. It sounds like the whole company is mad as hell and isn't going to take it anymore. Yet, it's not as if Microsoft has truly spent the last 20 years championing privacy much more than most other big tech companies. In common with its West Coast brethren, it's been too busy making money. Some states are taking the matter of privacy into their own jurisdiction. There are also signs of real interest among some members of Congress. The YouGov study found that significantly more people believe companies bear the primary responsibility for protecting data privacy, not government. Yet what do these companies do? They make privacy controls your responsibility. The large number of websites, devices and apps that people rely on to remain connected and engaged, a number that has grown even larger during this health crisis, makes it nearly impossible for individuals to navigate the privacy information overload and make informed decisions about how their data is used, said Brill. Too often we deliver that information in notices, difficult for lawyers and engineers to understand, much less the consumers. She concluded that trust is essential. It is time for government and business to work together to pass laws and reinvent practices to recognize the individual right to own and control personal data and to place the responsibility for protecting privacy where it belongs, on companies. I hope Microsoft management is taking heed of the study that they underwrote. Section 230 is a piece of internet legislation in the United States passed into law as part of the Communication Decency Act of 1996, formally codified as Section 230 of the Communications Act of 1934, provides immunity for website publishers from third-party content. The Communication Decency Act of 1996 is one of the most valuable tools for protecting freedom of expression and innovation on the Internet. Section 230 says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as a publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, online intermediaries that host or republish speech are protected against a range of laws that might otherwise be used to hold them legally responsible for what others say and do. The protected intermediaries include not only regular Internet service providers, that's ISPs, but also a range of interactive computer service providers, including basically any online service that publishes third-party content, though there are important exceptions for certain criminal and intellectual property-based claims. The Communication Decency Act 230 creates a broad protection that has allowed innovation and free speech online to flourish. This legal and policy framework has allowed for YouTube and Vimeo users to upload their own videos, Amazon and Yelp to offer countless user reviews, Craigslist to host classified ads, and Facebook and Twitter to offer social networking to hundreds of millions of internet users. Without this provision, it would be infeasible for online intermediaries to prevent objectionable content from cropping up on their site. Rather than face potential liability for their users' actions, most would likely not host any user content at all, or would need to protect themselves by being actively engaged in censoring what we say, what we see, and what we do online. The Communication Decency Act 230 is perhaps the most influential law to protect the kind of innovation that has allowed the Internet to thrive since 1996. Section 230 also offers it legal shield to bloggers who act as intermediaries by hosting comment on their blogs. Under the law, bloggers are not liable for comments left by readers, the work of guest bloggers, tips sent via email, or information received through RSS feeds. This legal protection can still hold even if a blogger is aware of the objectionable content or make editorial judgments. The legal protections provided by Section 230 are unique to U.S. law. European nations, Canada, Japan, and the vast majority of other countries do not have similar statutes on the books. While these countries have high levels of internet access, most prominent online services are based in the United States. This is in part because Section 230 makes the U.S. a safe haven for websites that want to provide a platform for controversial or political speech and a legal environment favorable to free expression. The law protects Facebook and Twitter from being sued for what their users post. Some legal experts say that if the laws change, the social media would become unrecognizable. Facebook and Twitter has been censoring selective users from posting items with views they do not agree with. They are not government agencies and not subject to the First Amendment on free speech. But since they have been granted immunity by the government from content posted, they are subject to the First Amendment. The executive order by the president earlier this year calls for federal regulators to review whether part of the Communication Decency Act, known as Section 230, should be revised or completely abolished. The law allows social media companies to provide a forum for users without being held liable for what they post. Experts and businesses often credit the protection passed in 1996 as one of the major reasons behind the rise of the internet economy. In recent years, both political parties have put social media companies under increased scrutiny. Republicans accuse the companies of unfairly censoring their posts, while Democrats complain that the companies fail to do enough to block misinformation, violent content, and hate speech. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, and Google CEO Sundar Pichai appeared before federal lawmakers today for a hearing into the protection of their companies received under a nearly 25-year-old law. The social media companies can't have their cake and eat at the same time. They want to be able to control the content of the media and still be immune from liability. One of the things we have been preaching is when buying a computer system, buy what you need today. What you may need for future computing will be cheaper and will be newer technology tomorrow. Looking back at what systems I have purchased or built in the past 45 years, I've acquired over 24 computer systems. There are multiple systems in use. The average product life cycle of each computer is roughly 3 years before they become doorstops. With the recent Labor Day and Amazon Prime Day special sales extended into October, one could easily surmise that blockbuster prices would not be all that different from Black Friday specials. So I started to shop for another system. Another thing we preach is when buying a computer system, if you have an immediate computer need, don't wait for a special sale. In my case, I decided I could wait. Earlier this month, I had half-jokingly said that Black Friday sales have moved up to October the 13th, from the day after Thanksgiving Day. That was the date Amazon had announced that it would be the start of their Prime Day special. Prime Day is an annual deal event exclusively for Prime members, delivering 2 days of special savings on tons of items. Prime Day 2020 was on October the 13th and the 14th. Well, it turns out I had a pleasant surprise. The Black Friday specials are even lower prices than the Labor Day sales. Dell, HP, Lenovo, Staple, and Best Buy have come out early this Monday with their Black Friday specials on computers. Some are advertising Black Friday sneak peeks, hinting that what was announced is just the tip of more to follow. A quick comment about what not to buy if you're shopping for a low-cost Windows 10 PC. They are usually equipped with 64 GB of flash memory storage, and check to see if the storage is soldered on. Most low-end PC systems today are equipped with memory and storage soldered on. Microsoft now recommends as a Windows 10 minimum storage requirement to be 64 GB. If you were to buy one of the systems with only 64 GB, you'll have about 10 GB for application installation and working storage. With one or two Windows 10 update, you'd run out of storage space in a quick time. At that point in time, short of replacing the system, you might want to do some storage reassignment, such as having the download subdirectory move to the micro SD card. The downside is you'll run at a low speed. But that is still better than having an idle system that is not upgradable. Presenting Marty Winston with his home automation, Tech or Treat.
Let's take a journey through your imagination. It's the near future. You're in a parking lot. You've just taken your seat in your self-driving car. You tell it to take you home. It starts up. It sets the temperature, the entertainment system, the lighting, and everything exactly the way you like them. It starts backing out, and it makes a new sound. The sound of one self-driving car colliding with three others, as by some ironically coincidental twist of fate, all had started backing out at precisely the same instant. Repairing the damage is going to be expensive. So is getting home anytime soon. But here is the big question. All that automation, all that sophistication, is it tech or treat? Meet Thaddeus B. Lynch, a worker of a very few years in the future, who toils much less laboriously than his predecessors. His factory, you see, is a model of IoT. Yes, the Internet of Things has come into its own, in full flower, making sure customer orders can be scheduled for production with no parts shortages and with finished goods shipments already slotted into the manifests. It is a wondrous orchestration of many different machines and systems, all working to the common good. Until, that is, a truck passes by carrying some older automation with protocol flaws that clash with those of the factory. Factory lines start throwing half-built products like pies in a Three Stooges feature. Soon, the doors are blocked, the connections to the outside world fried, and Mr. Thaddeus B. Lynch left to enjoy the benefits of his thoroughly automated company for just the few days left until his demise.
Tech or treat?
It's 10 years in the future. You've managed to build a time machine, but it's only good for one-way travel to the past. You choose the 1960s, a calculated decision. Your intent is to become the most successful business person ever. You know the technologies that will become important. You know the following decade will see explosive growth in key business and technology areas. And you have immersed yourself in all the technology developments of 30 years. The door closes, the button glows, you push it, and you find yourself at an office building, carrying a forged letter you had prepared, announcing you to this stalwart company as its newly hired director of advanced initiatives. They escort you to a corner office. You have a list of other companies to contact, and you sit at your desk, a smile on your face, which quickly fades. There's something that must certainly be a telephone, but you have no idea how to operate it. Nor can you work the machine that sends and receives documents. They call it a fax, but you've never seen one before. The entire building is full of the best technology of the 1960s, and all of it completely unfamiliar. You are discovered, demoted, and left to work in the mailroom. Your knowledge of the coming era, worthless.
Tech or treat?
It's just a week or two from now in the present era. Winter and sunset comes early. You've been out for a walk, anything to get out of the house, chatting on your phone as you go. Almost home now, and the call has ended. Not far to go now, just across the street. Never mind going to the corner to cross. You turn on the phone's flashlight as you step into the street. Oh, dear. Looks like those calls lasted too long. A car rounds the corner. Your light goes dark. The battery's dead. And a moment later, so are you.
Tech or treat?
It's nighttime, and you finally see the email message you've been waiting for. You've been accepted for the new reward credit card, one you'd never heard of before, but it deposits your reward money directly into your bank account. You go to the card's website and fill in the bank routing number and your account number. Just for signing up, it says, you will get your first $500 reward the very next day. You go to bed smiling, looking forward to the next morning, thinking about what you'll do with that $500. You log into your bank's website, eager to see that new deposit in your account. What you see instead is a zero balance. It was them, not you, who got rewarded.
Tag or treat.
It's late at night. The kids are in bed. Your spouse is asleep. You sneak into your home office, fire up your PC, and set your browser to permissive. For the next 2 hours, you browse through a variety of videos depicting many adult activities that you're glad you don't have to explain to your spouse or the children. Enough, you're getting tired. You shut the screen and head to bed. The next morning, there's no sleeping in. With the kids schooling at home, imagine the scene as opening your computer screen resumed the video you'd left behind. The kids are crying, the spouse is redefining what angry means, and your life just took a very wrong turn.
Tag or treat.
It's nearing the end of the month, and your smartphone has exhausted your data plan. But you need to navigate to an unfamiliar destination for an appointment. You remember the dashboard navigation display in your car and decide to let that guide you. The updates were too expensive to buy every year, but how much can the city change in just a few years? You enter the address and the voice begins instructing you on turns. Construction? That wasn't on the map. Streets that were changed to one way in the wrong direction, and one of those has become the on-ramp for a long bridge. The next thing you know, you're in a different state, in an unfamiliar area, and almost out of gas. Worse, the stations you see don't look safe or friendly. You can guess which way to go, but there's nothing to tell you how to get there.
Tech or treat.
You think your technology prowess is the best in the neighborhood. So on Halloween night, you'll be showcasing the spookiest, most decorated yard ever. Fog machines, laser lights, projectors, pop-up creatures, blowing yarn that feels like spider webs, sound effects of thunder and sinister laughter. But just as darkness falls, there's a spike on the power line that fries your controller. The lasers target your own doors and windows. The fog guns turn and blanket your house. The spooky sound effects play way too fast and too softly and sound more like mice in an arcade than anything scary. Worse, your electronic door locks won't let you in. The alarm system won't turn off. The neighborhood adults and children are hee-hawing at your ineptitude, and your surveillance cameras are sending live video all over the internet.
Tech or treat?
So many of us, so often, wear our technology prowess like a badge, like some permission to brag and prattle. No one ought to be judged based on their tools and conveniences. We're all just people. Granted, on Halloween, we're all people with a little too much sugar content and perhaps a little too little in the way of social inhibitions. Go with the first and avoid the second. We all, and I do mean all of us, we all wish you a safe and happy and healthy Halloween. It doesn't have to be scary. This year, in fact, it's not even the scariest day on the current calendar. What is the scariest day? Election Day, of course. Next time, because it will be just after Halloween, it will already be several days into the holiday shopping season. And in a 2020 context, that's not exactly a familiar place. Did you want guidance? That may be impossible. But what you will find is our segment, Dazed and Glazed for the Holidays. Whatever else it is, it's certain to be more fun than listening to the election recaps.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Remote attendance is via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets November the 13th. That's Friday the 13th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, November the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. And the Brookdale Computer Users Group, well, they meet on a Thursday, and they normally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month, but it happens to be Thanksgiving Day. So go to their website to get more information as when the new date will be for the meeting. Their website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. And if you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. And remember, this weekend, we turn the clock back. We're going to go from daylight savings time to standard time. At the end of Saturday, we turn the clock back. Hawaii and Arizona are the two U.S. states that don't observe daylight saving time. Navajo Nation in northeastern Arizona does follow daylight savings time. If you live in Hawaii or Arizona, don't set the clock back an hour. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.